This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This week on Grub Eats World. I feel like it's because of documentaries like this and the conversations that we're all kind of having post Me Too that kind of encapsulates all kinds of these like secret abuses that were happening. Like these conversations will hopefully make it harder for the next generation to experience those things. So as uncomfortable as it is, it's something that we kind of have to do if we want things to change, because staying quiet is what led to so much of this happening.
When the spawn meets world.
What up, bros?
What up, bros?
Hey, welcome to Bro Meets World.
When it's Bro Meets World.
Your Boy Meets World fan cast. I'm Siege.
And I'm Tony Curtis.
And we are having a class discussion episode. Tony, tell them why we're doing this.
Honestly, guys, we just saw the Quiet On Set documentary, and it was like, hey, we got to call our bro mates together. You and I have to talk about it and figure out like how we feel about it. I got to be honest, I am not looking forward to this episode today. I am sweating. I feel uncomfortable. I literally just finished watching episode 4 like an hour ago, and like, dude, I don't feel good. Like, I just don't feel good. Like, I don't know.
Well, so I will say a few things. One, I listened to our episode on Pod Meets World's episode, very special episode, where they kind of like got ahead of it. I watched all 4 episodes of Quiet on the Set. I watched the response videos. I've been doing my work. I just want everyone to know that I've done my work, and I have a few things to say. One is way to teach me to speak before I have all the information. I'll just say that. I'll say that much. Two, you said something in our episode that I thought was really important, where you said a lot of nostalgia is clamoring for the idea of something and not knowing the reality. And I thought about that a lot while I was watching this documentary. And overall, I'm looking forward to have this conversation, because I think that this is one of the best episodes I can think of in terms of holding myself accountable to the same standards that I have asked of the cast previously, and not shying away from having the tough conversations, and kind of having to reexamine some of my own perspectives. So that's how we'll start this. But sorry, you guys, I know like we all hate it, but we live in capitalism, so we're gonna do a little bit of the housekeeping, which is to say, you guys, a lot of you reached out to me and asked what we thought about this documentary, what we thought about the documentary now that we what we thought about our response now that we have seen the documentary. And I just want to say to that, if you want to reach out to us, please do so at Bro Meets World. You can email us at brometsworld@gmail.com. You guys have been very active on YouTube, on Instagram, on our Patreon. We appreciate it always. So you guys, if you're listening to this phone, go follow us on listening to this on your phone, follow us on Instagram. And if you're watching us on YouTube or Spotify, again, follow, subscribe. We appreciate it. Give us a rating. Now that we have done that, we're just going to get right into it. As I said earlier, we are talking about Quiet on the Set, the dark side of kids' TV. Tony, why don't you give them the details of this, just so we're all on the same page?
Sure, yeah. It's a quick synopsis. This is a TV miniseries I saw on HBO Max, whatever you want to call it, but I think it's Discovery ID who investigated Investigation Discovery that aired it initially. It's 4 episodes. Episode 1 and 2 premiered on March 17th, and then episodes 3 and 4 premiered on March 18th of 2024. It's directed by Mary Robertson and Emma Schwartz, and it features several child actors, including Drake Bell, Giovanni Samuels, Kyle Sullivan, Katrina Johnson, Brian Hearn, and several other industry insiders. Like I said, it's available on Max. You can also watch it on Hulu and Amazon.
And for those of you who did not watch it, the summary of Quiet On Set, The Dark Side of Kids Television, is a docuseries that covers the emotional and sexual abuse suffered by child actors on Nickelodeon in the mid-90s and 2000s. Child pornography and sexual assault are discussed in detail. The documentary also explores the racial challenges faced by former child actors, including the pressures of being the token Black girl and dealing with racism and stereotypical roles on set. The one-on-one interviews contain sexual language, as well as descriptions of continual sexual assault. Both victims and their parents are shown tearing up as they recount their stories. So, first thoughts. I understand that you're just out of this. First thoughts.
You know, just a few key things I want to say before we jump into the specifics. One, I've kind of been talking for a while now how I feel like nostalgia has like a good and bad side to it. And, you know, I can't help but like see like how, you know, politically America's kind of waking up to like, oh, we've kind of been fed lies. And I think as millennials, it's like as we dive into more and more subcultures, we're like, it's all kind of been bullshit. And I have a really hard time. I had a hard time watching this documentary from the jump, like from the very first episode, because it immediately got me in with all of this classic Nickelodeon nostalgia. And to talk, like, I cannot downplay how important Nickelodeon was in the 90s, because I mean, as the documentary says, there was two spots. There was Disney Channel, if you were lucky at first. Not even everyone had that at first, but Nickelodeon was it for us. And all of the shows that were featured, all of the shows that were discussed, I mean, I'm a little bit older of a millennial, so I didn't stick around for some of the later shows that were covered in the documentary, but so many of them meant so much to me. These actors that were in the shows, specifically All That and all these, like, meant so much to me, and I was just heartbroken watching it. Just a few other things that I want to circle back to later, but I just want to mention the role of children supporting their families financially, I think, is something I really want to kind of get to the bottom of. I want to kind of talk about how capitalism, I think, plays a part in forcing artists to be uncomfortable because there's so few places where artists can actually make profit. So they're often the first to be compromised by situations like this. And just kind of like, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it, but there were so many like innuendos and like inside jokes and like weird things that was like shoved into our entertainment as kids that I think our generation maybe normalized in a way that kind of makes us all victims of this. I don't know. So I'm just kind of like swirling around all of that, you know, and that's not even touching the details of the documentary, but what are your opening impressions, your first thoughts?
My opening impressions is, you know, I will take the same approach as I did previously when you were like, oh, if you found out your husband was like a murderer, you would like, you're going to tell me that you wouldn't be surprised. And I'm like, no, actually it makes me like, you know, it's a possibility. And I look at this documentary as so upsetting, so frustrating, but also not really surprising. You know, having lived in LA, having learned a lot, like seeing kind of the double talk that LA is about and like knowing how many people are able to continue to be in positions of powers and not be good at their jobs and not be responsible adults, but they are money makers. That is kind of what I saw going into this. And then also, I will say, I feel a little bit bamboozled, like now that I've learned a little bit more details about who the person was that Hot Meets World was kind of like covering for and like their response to it and like the actual context of it. All of that is something that we will address. We will get to it. But ultimately, I look at this documentary as doing a good service. I feel like we like both, I'm gonna be honest, both Pod Meets World's coverage and like their stories, what you and I have been doing in terms of like looking back and rewatching all these episodes and like exploring it, and then also documentaries like Quiet on the Set are all shining a spotlight on child actors and young Hollywood that I feel like is deserved. And that's how I see this.
100%.
I see this as we don't know how to do better if we don't know what was wrong in the first place. And hate it, love it, no matter what you feel about it, we are all better for being aware of what actually is going on.
I'll second that and agree by just saying that as I was, kind of thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, one of the things I thought was, wow, I feel like it's because of documentaries like this and the conversations that we're all kind of having post Me Too, that kind of encapsulates all kinds of these like secret abuses that were happening. Like these conversations will hopefully make it harder for the next generation to experience those things. So as uncomfortable as it is, it's something that we kind of have to do if we want things to change, because staying quiet is what led to so much of this happening. So
Absolutely. Quiet on the set. It's part of that. Okay, just so to let you guys know how we're gonna do this, we're going to cover it in like sections and chunks, just so you're all able to like follow along. We're gonna cover Dan Schneider and the Nickelodeon of it all. Then we're gonna talk about Drake Bell and Brian Peck. Then we're gonna go into Pod Meets World and our reactions to our reaction. And then we're gonna have some after the doc conversations and final thoughts. So starting off with like episodes one and two really are structured around Dan Schneider and his tenure at Nickelodeon. This is the dude who was responsible for all that. This is the dude for the Amanda Show. He was Nickelodeon's golden child for a very, very long time. And there is a lot to say just in terms of the toxic workplace that he had, how he treated women on his staff, and what the kids who grew up working under him had to say, which I honestly feel like is some of the most important things. Like, what did the children who worked under him had to say? And so yeah, that's where I want to start. Tony?
It's Dan Schneider sucks, bro, because he's such
Yeah.
truly like he's such a huge part of children's entertainment. That it's almost like recently, like I've been noticing how often Diddy will just hop on someone else's record being like, I thought I told you that we won't stop. And I'm like, why did you ruin this Mariah Carey song for me? Like that's what Dan Schneider is. It's like this thing where it's like, I don't know that I can go back and watch an All That episode the same way now. Like, not that I often go back, but every now and then I have a nostalgia time where I'm just like, oh, I want to go back and watch some childhood entertainment. All That was so important to me. It was the first time I saw, diversity, the first time I saw like kids having like fun putting on the show. I actually auditioned to be in All That.
Did you really?
Yeah, now knowing what I know now, they were probably like, we already have a chubby black one, thanks. But I actually did, and I remember being obsessed with that show and wanting nothing more to be than to be a Nick kid. And like, thank God, like it didn't happen. Like, it's the a lot of times you like I want to talk about for a second Katrina Johnson,
Yeah,
who worked
Katrina
on,
Johnson.
the show starts with Katrina. She's the youngest member of All That. And she comes onto the show and she's apparently a favorite of Dan Schneider. They talk about this throughout the series about how Dan Schneider would often play favorites and kind of use his position of power to be like, oh, maybe you'll get a spinoff if you're, nice to me or whatever, like things like that. Katrina talks about how, she was brought in and she was kind of a favorite of Dan until Amanda Bynes came along and she was kind of phased out of the show. She also talks about the role that her body played in it, like how like people were judging her for first gaining weight and then like just developing as a woman and how that affected her. The reason I'm bringing up Katrina Johnson is just because I specifically remember watching All That and her watching and feeling that she was getting phased out. She was a favorite character of mine in the season one. And by the time Amanda Bynes joined the show, I remember actually feeling a certain way about Amanda Bynes because I was like, oh, she's taken like skits from actors that I really enjoy. And I just remember her really being pushed to the forefront. And now I kind of understand why in a different way. And it's like the worst way to discover it. I don't know.
Well, it's so funny that you say that, because like I felt the exact same thing, like seeing Katrina drop, like again, the documentary has like a lot of people from all like the original All That. And like, mm-hmm. you know, it was one of Dan Schneider's crowning achievements. And he did bring like SNL to Nickelodeon. But again, I watched it being like, oh, that was right. Nickelodeon was built on the backs of people of color and like all like us doing all the work and getting it there and showing that it could be done. And then years later, it completely being whitewashed, and it's hard pressed to find stars and leads of color.
Yeah.
On Nickelodeon. So that there's just that. But then also this idea that I too remember watching Katrina and her being the star and her being like in a lot of skits and everywhere. And then all of a sudden, like, it's funny, I even remember her developing, but not like in like a weird way. Like,
yeah.
She got older. And then Amanda coming on and me being like, I'm not fucking with Amanda. You know, like
well, to be fair to Amanda Bynes, she was the first new cast member that was brought on. So like, it wasn't like a tradition the way it is now where like every season there's new cast members. Like, she was the first time that someone like new got added to the cast. So it felt a little odd.
Well, yeah. I think the thing with me with Amanda, which is what you were talking about, is that I just originally remember as a child being like, you feel like a plant, you know, like it's like you feel like I'm being told I have to like you. And while I do love some of your bits, I also feel like you're going for a different tone of comedy, and that you're becoming the Urkel, which is makes sense because they ended up giving Amanda her own spinoff. But like, I just remember being like, oh, I liked it best when it was an ensemble, and then when you got pulled out and you got made the star, I felt differently. So anyway, all of this is like that we're talking about All That, but I want to say that I also pulled out the idea and noted that Johnson had said that she began to gain weight and she was favorite when she was young, and then she started to develop, and I was like, oh, all of these like little things. And I think one of the most important things to me about this entire documentary is the idea that a lot of what is being said and a lot of what is happening isn't like hard evidence. Yeah. Like, someone could say that you're speculating, like it's speculation, but when they all add up, you're like, no, something was going on here, you know?
Can I just, I want to interject that, because I felt like there was a lot of moments where that was the case, where it was like, this is gray, this is murky. And if I were trying to report someone who is doing this, maybe as a child, I wouldn't have the language to do so. I don't want to move on from Amanda Bynes too quickly, because I want to say this. First of all, I, as an adult, can now see how talented she was. When they're showing her doing a stand-up routine at, like, the comedy club when she was, like, 12, I was just like, oh, she is incredibly talented. Like, when they showed the clips of her, I'm like, wow, what a bright comedic light who had such natural talent. And, you know, to see the way that all of her... the way she was treated, to see the way it affected her, like, truly breaks my heart. I just want to say this about Amanda Bynes. There's a moment in the documentary, I forget if it's episode one or two, where they're saying Amanda joined the show and the cast would be hanging out on All That, but we couldn't find Amanda because she'd be disappeared with Dan alone for hours and hours, or we couldn't find her. And I'm like, see, that's some shit that actually is not a gray area. There is no reason why Amanda should be alone with Dan Schneider. And I understand that, like, as the documentary is going on, they're like, hey, it was actually quite common for adults to be left alone with children. But, like, for someone of his position to spend that much time with her, I don't want to, like, bring in a lot of, like, external information, because we are talking about this documentary specifically. But there is this thing that's going around about how Amanda Bynes had, like, a fake Twitter account, like a Twitter account that was her own after her parents, like, basically took over her Twitter account and wouldn't let her post on it, where she mentions getting impregnated and having an abortion by a boss of hers.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I know she didn't tell her story in this, but it feels like there's so much more to the Amanda Bynes-ness of why Dan Schneider is a piece of shit. Like, it all comes back to Dan Schneider being a piece of shit, but I feel like Amanda Bynes plays a way bigger part in that than was actually even discussed in this documentary. So I just wanted to mention that.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think also, like, so for me, I think that you can tell just in the way that Dan Schneider is talked about, there were two things that stood out to me. One is this man got off on power plays.
Yes.
And he got off on making people do uncomfortable things like that. And that is like, whether it's children and forcing them to be in situations that they don't want to be in, whether it's colleagues and people who work for him, putting them in situations where they didn't want to, like, he got off on, there was like the editor who talks about how she would work 20-hour days and not be allowed to go to the bathroom. And I was like, oh, that's a power play. Like, yeah. That's what that is. That's just a power play. That's being like, I hold your well-being in my life. You yep. can't leave this room unless I say you can. And again, having women massage him on set. Those are power moves. Those are just yep. a way of saying, hey, I want everyone in this room to know that I have the power and everything lives and dies by my opinion. And I think that that is so important because it kind of bleeds into everything else.
100%. And the power play of it, like, it was such a, like, the way he would fuck with his crew members, the way he would, like, you know, do these like inappropriate jokes that like they had to go along with. They tell a story about one of the female writers being in the writer's room, and Dan goes up to her and says, hey, I want you to pretend to be sodomized as a joke. It would be funny. Her doing it and being humiliated and eventually like leaving because it, like, I just, the humiliation that some of these female crew members had to go through in order to just have job security is really striking. Even these female writers who were told that they had to split their salaries in order to work for Dan. Like, I truly just don't think this motherfucker likes women. And I think part of that has to do with he doesn't want people calling him out. And it feels like he has more control when it's a guy's room where he can like joke around and be like, oh yeah, I may have said something inappropriate, but you know, the guys know it's just a joke. And like, you're not going to be one of those girls that are going to be a problem, are you? Like, that shit is like, it's toxic. But knowing who Dan is, it's also like, he wants yes men. He wants people who aren't going to bring up issues. He wants people who aren't going to be a problem. You know, we haven't talked about it yet, but, you know, in all that, in the later seasons, there's an actor named Brian Hearn.
Yep.
Who, his mom saw some shit and said some shit, and then he wasn't invited back. And, like, it obviously has had lasting impact on him as an actor, and his relationship with his mom even was kind of in trouble for a while. But like, the one person who did stand up was a woman, a Black woman at that, I'll say, and they removed her. So yep. it's just one of those things where it was like, I just don't think he liked having women around because of the accountability that brought.
This is not to say that anyone is required to do this, I will say, but it is funny to me because I was watching this and I knew immediately. I was like, oh, Brian Hearn's mom, she's the real one. She's like, yeah. The reason they were like, oh, Dan always kind of like kept Brian at a distance. Like, a lot of the Black a lot of the Black cast members said that they felt like Dan played favorites, that he always distanced himself from them. And I was like, that's because Black people are more likely, like Black children are more likely to tell their parents, and Black people are more likely to say something and not go quietly into that night. And I think like there's a lot of that. This is not to say that anyone else's parents who didn't come forward didn't have their own reasons for not to. I think it's really sad when you get the representation of so many parents who, like, whose children were abused and how they react to it. And I was like, to your point, A, capitalism being a really big part of this. A lot of people, a lot of kids are paying for their families to get out of wherever they wanted to be. But also this idea of what society will say. And I will say that, I'll say this, in the Black community, what society will say is, did you protect your child? But in other communities, that's not necessarily the case. It is a blame game. It is like a, what were you doing? What was going on? And you have to keep up appearances, especially if money is on the line.
Let me just throw this in here real fast. It wasn't included in the documentary, but I later found this out on TikTok. Just speaking of, like, you know, we were talking about the Black community, even Shelby Wu, I don't know if you remember that show, the Mystery Files of Shelby Wu. She posted a TikTok saying, when you speak up against the creepy things that happen and you get replaced by another Asian actress on your own show. Wow. And I'm just like, oh, so this was everywhere. Like, there's like, the documentary is the tip of the iceberg to everything that was going on.
Yeah. Do you know the show Just Jordan?
Mm-mm.
All right. It was a Nickelodeon show starring Lil JJ was his name.
Okay.
And the whole reason I'm saying is, like, someone pulled up a tweet where Just Jordan or Lil JJ says something along the lines of, this was years ago, even before the documentary came out. He said something along the lines of, my show got canceled because I refused to serve people as a child. And like, those were not the words he said. If you want to look, go Google it. But basically, yeah, he was like, oh, that's why, like, people were coming after me, there were predators on set, and I refused to give in to that, and so my show was canceled. And the number of people who are punished for speaking up, like, again, you had talked about it earlier, the one of the writers who found out that they were being underpaid and filed a complaint only for Dan to call her and basically threaten and say, not only if I find out it's you, not only will you lose this job, you will never work at Nickelodeon or any Viacom project.
Yeah.
That was really important.
You know, one of the things that really bothered me about the Dan Schneiderness of it, and it kind of relates to Brian Peck, well, I know we're going to get to him separately, but was this idea of, like, hey, it's going to be really funny if we're able to sneak in, like, adult comedy and adult visuals into a children's show. And I feel like that was, like, a little inside ha-ha joke that, like, him and Brian and, like, other people, like, really got off on. Now, in terms of, like, that power play, just being like, oh, not only is this gonna, like, scratch my own little fetish, but, like, I can get away with it, and, like, pursuing that, and, like, that would just feel so malicious to me. And it also, like I said at the top of the episode, about how, like, I feel like we're all kind of victims of this, because this is the content that we were fed as children, thinking, like, oh, this is how kids are, where it's like, no, kids aren't constantly putting things in their mouth, are getting, like, things sprayed on their face, or, like, having their feet on the online. Like, it's just, it's all weird. It's all weird.
Well, so that's funny. It's funny that you say that, because, like, I remember even as a kid, I was like, oh, I don't find this funny. And people will go back and look, and it's funny because I'm going to get back to it in general, but Dan Schneider's response, he said things like along the lines of, every joke was run by a committee. Every joke was, like, had writer's room. Every joke had parents on set, and blah, 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 blah. And A, that does not take accountability for the power play, which is what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And B, just because something made it through, you and I have watched several episodes and we were like, this is not funny. What are we doing? Like, just because it made it through does not mean that it was okay. Just because at the time no one brought it up. Like, we also live in a machine where they're like, did you create the content? Did that happen? Do we, like you said, there's a lot of living in that gray area. This show, or Dan Schneider's productions, love to live in that gray area and of sexualization. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why is there a glory hole joke in this kids cartoon. Why is there
penises on this kid's costume? Like, crazy shit.
Also, like, the idea of, like, constantly putting the kids in spandex and superhero costumes. It's like, yeah, no, it's fine for a sketch, but why are you constantly doing it? Like, that's it's the frequency that's also the problem.
That, and, like, one of the things I didn't really notice until I started watching it, because, like I said, a lot of the older, like, I stopped watching Nickelodeon around, like, what? Probably around 9/11. Like, it wasn't really something I carried on. I had moved on to MTV and kind of more adult stuff at that time. But when I see clips of, like, Victorious and iCarly and Zoe 101, I'm like, wow, they really had these girls in bikinis and shit. Like, they really had them in, like, skimpy, like, outfits. And I'm just like, I don't remember that being a thing when I was, like, I remember Alex Mack wearing, like, baggy jeans. You know what I mean? Like, it was just a completely different way to showcase children. And one of the writers or someone said, like, Dan would use these girls' bodies as, like, a marketing tactic, too. And I'm just like, for a 12-year-old? Like, it's weird. It's just very weird, so.
Well, I think I'm going to say, because you and I have talked about this before, specifically at the time, I think we were dealing with a lot of immaturity, immature men at that time. Late 90s, early 2000s. If you look at the comedy, it is a lot of Arrested Development. You have the role Ferrell's, the Adam Sandler's, like, all of this comedy was really, really childish, really, really gross, but grown men doing it.
Yep.
And it was accepted at the time. I think, like, that cast of Hollywood thought that this was funny and that this was edgy and that this was acceptable. And as we've gotten older, it's like, no, that all of it was inappropriate.
Inappropriate and also, like, the lowest hanging fruit. The comedy does not translate because it was such an easy joke that's distasteful.
Absolutely. I do want to talk a little bit about a few things. One, the Amanda of it all, to see the amount of access that Dan Schneider was able to have with Amanda, the video of him in the hot tub, and she is saying, hey, this was your idea. Like, she, like, it's so funny to, like, look at these things and just, like, kind of casually be like, oh, wait a minute, this person saw talent and is kind of grooming it in a way to where this child would not know to say something. It makes me feel really bad for the way her story turned out, because there are so many demons that she obviously was facing. Sure. But to see that amount of talent, I don't want to say go to waste, but kind of be corrupted by 100%. An older man, is just something I wanted to acknowledge and, like, really put out there. And then I want to talk about the other pedophiles that were notified on set.
Before we move on from Amanda, just something I want to say, like, when you're talking about seeing her talent, like, I truly, when I was watching her clips, I was like, wow, the closest thing I can relate her to when she was, like, in her prime is, like, Lucille Ball. Like, her comedic timing, her physical comedy, the way she would give her all to a joke. I'm like, wow, what a star she was. Like, truly a star. And we talk a lot about, like, sexual abuse. We talk a lot about how, like, there was the kind of aggression that would happen from Dan about him just snapping or yelling or humiliating people. The other thing about Dan is that he saw Amanda as his meal ticket out of children's entertainment, that he tried to attach himself to her as she, you know, he created What I Like About You. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Until watching this. So, like, he really was trying to hang on to her for as long as possible. And it wasn't until she kind of fell through his grips that he returned to children's entertainment. And it's just interesting that, like, there's financial exploitation happening with Dan as well, not just all the other kinds of abuse.
Yeah, again, power wherever power is. Mm-hmm. We are, again, I want to talk about some of the other things. I will say it is complex because the documentary very, very rightfully explores the fact that it is not just Dan Schneider. There were other people who were predators who were allowed to be on set and interact with children. And one of the things that I think is most telling is there's the example of Jason Handy, I think it is. Jason Hardy. He is.
That's a tough one for me. Honestly, Jason's a hard one.
Yeah, he was someone who was allowed to basically take children from their parents alone And
he was a PA. He was a PA on set. He was in charge of directing the kids where to go. He was also in charge of like organizing things with the mothers and like how like the parents could be with the kids. He played a key role in that.
And I'm not going to say that that isn't a role that like a young man shouldn't have. I am going to say that we should, in fact, be mindful of who is being alone with children and at what point in time and how long. I cannot express this enough. I do not like being alone with children ever at all. Yeah. Like, I'm like, why? Because I was like, I have no reason to be around kids. It doesn't make sense. So for him
specifically, like with a kid one-on-one, like why aren't there other kids around to, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, there's that. And then the idea of him giving his information to the kid and the kid and him are emailing. And just like, again, before we even go into
Jason
of like what actually happens, I just want to say that I want to be understanding of one of the children who was abused. Her name was Brandy. And one of the things about Brandy's mom, who is really vocal in this, is she kind of like ignored the signs. And I just want to say that that's the thing that I'm having a hard time with. It is not that I expect parents to know everything that's going on with their children. It is when you hear that your child is messaging with an adult consistently, what's that about? You know, it's, like there has to be some kind of like something goes off.
Brandy's mom, who's called MJ in this, I just have to say, like, I don't know who's listening that has relationships to her, no disrespect to her. Fuck MJ, because not only did she know that her like 8-year-old, like below like 9-year-old, was constantly messaging this guy. Jason sent Brandy a photo of him naked, explicit, being explicit, saying like, basically saying like, hey, I want you to know I was thinking about you as he was naked. The mom saw this and her first thought was, well, if I call police, they're going to think I'm a bad mom. And that was the moment I was like, fuck you, MJ. Like this, the fact that you care more about what other people think about you versus protecting your daughter or helping protect other children from this man who has access to children is there's no excuse for it. Like you can't, like, I don't know. To me, that's probably one of like the parents in some way are complicit in this in somehow in the way that they've allowed, not all parents, like there's some great parents. Drake's dad, I think, is a great parent. Like there's so many aspects of like parents who really showed up, but to see that sent to your kid and think about, well, what are people going to think of me? Is I really lost it at that.
To your point, A, that was definitely one of my things. And I think that this is important because this is why I very often advocate for speaking up and doing what's right, even in the face of what other people might think, because the first reaction being, well, they're going to think I'm a bad mom. Well, they're going to, it's like your first reaction, your priority should be to protect your child and to protect other people's children. The fact that you didn't say anything, like that's what I have a problem with. Like if you see something, the see something, say something, the thing is, even if it's not the cops, because don't get me wrong, cops, who knows how they would have handled it, but you definitely should have said something. You definitely should have made record. You definitely should have, like, they're talking about, it's so funny, Brian talks about how he didn't tell his mom certain things because he knew how his mom would react. And I was like, but what we don't know as children is that's your parents trying to protect you. Sure. And, like, and I think that it's important to note that the cases where the parents are involved in this documentary, they also are removed. They are removed. And I think that that also should be very telling when you have a child who, for all intents and purposes, is not being abused at home. They seem to have caring parents. If someone at work is trying to remove those parents from the picture, you have to ask yourself why.
Remove the parents and also disrupt the relationship between the child and the parent. That happened with Brian and his mom. It also happened with Drake and his dad in terms of like, while, you know, the parent that's causing the issue is, it's almost like the predator knows to like insert themselves in between in a way that's really like hard to grapple with, that they're like, oh, I'm gonna go as far as to like break up your relationship with your parents so I can get more access to you. Dan did the same thing with Amanda and her emancipation. Like And it wasn't until her emancipation got declined that he lost access to Amanda. So it was things like that where it's just like, man, these people will really kind of try to remove a child from their parents for their own perversions.
To that point, you made me think of like the red flags that should go off. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into it next. But one of the things that really bothered me with the parents is the episode starts to go into Brian Peck. And with Brian Peck, he is the person that Will and Ryder were talking about in their episode where they talked about befriending and being friends with a groomer, with someone who is a convicted sex offender, and how they came to his side. We will get to that, I promise you. But what's also important to me is there are red flags that I am so curious as to how people ignored. Yeah. When Kyle Sullivan talks about he went to their house, he went to Brian Peck's house, and Brian Peck had a photo of John Wayne Gacy.
It was a self-portrait. It was a painting.
Yes. And then Brian Peck says, A, I got that from the man himself. B, we're pen pals. C, we continue to talk to each other to this day. And D, I am proudly telling you this story. This is not something that you got out of me. This is not something that they discovered after the fact. This was something that he told people at a party.
He had later revealed that he's become pen pal friends with John Wayne Gacy and has a slew of letters that he keeps by his bed. Can I just asterisk this real fast, just for people who don't know, because this actually came up. John Wayne Gacy was a serial killer who dressed up like a clown and molested boys. So like for that to be the dude that Brian's like, oh, I talk to him all the time. And all these adults heard it and were just like, huh, that's weird. We got to ask more questions.
Absolutely. Like, there are a few things. The reason why I brought this up, one, you made a reference to John Wayne Gacy in our previous episode that I thought was, like, you just did it. You were like, what if, like, John Wayne Gacy had, and so the idea that it, like, came back in this documentary was, like, so crazy to me. But also, it is one of the clearest ideas of sometimes the problem can be staring you in the face mm-hmm. and people will walk right by. Like, I can't, that if someone, like, we're very familiar that if someone, like, has Nazi paraphernalia, mm-hmm. or, you know, like, if there's, like, it's very clear if you are looking and you're willing to pay attention, and I can't stop thinking about how much of this is just fueled by money and our dependency on our jobs, and mm-hmm. the idea that so many parents, so many people are forced to look past obvious red flags in order to make ends meet.
Just something I want to say while we're on the story about Brian's house party that he threw. Yeah. Something that like he shares, a quality he shares with Dan Schneider, is this Arrested Development thing. Is this I'm a big kid in like an adult body, so much so that both of them, their homes were kind of decorated to be kind of like children play areas. And people would say the same thing about Michael and Neverland. And this is kind of what I was talking about in terms of how nostalgia sometimes can get dangerous because it can keep you locked into a mindset that you are actually younger than you are. And if Brian is walking around surrounded by toys from his childhood, this motherfucker could convince himself that he is a peer and an equal to someone that's younger than him. And I'm not saying that nostalgia is innately dangerous, but I just think it's interesting that when you see these stories come out of men after men after men, a lot of them have fascinations with childhood shit. And so it's just, that's just something that I keep seeing and I'm trying to figure out in my own head.
Well, now we're getting to the drink of it all, because I thought, like, when you said they have interest in childlike shit, I think that it is not to say that anyone who has interest in childlike things
sure.
are a problem, but it is to say that you have to ask why. What is mm-hmm. what is their relationship with this thing? Because even Drake talks about, the episode goes and it talks about, hey, we had Jason Hardy who was convicted of doing inappropriate things. And then later there was a second predator who named Brian Peck. He abused someone. Does anyone know who that person is? And then the big reveal is it's Drake Bell from Drake and Josh. And then Drake comes and he's telling his story for the very first time. And what I thought was interesting about Drake, when he tells the story of how he met Brian, he talks about how Brian shared interests with him and how much they had in common. And he goes, now that I think about it, that was probably intentional. And that's my thing, is like, these people had interest in childlike things, but they also use that interest to get children to trust them, because shared experiences, shared interest is the greatest way to get close to someone.
Sure. The Brian Peck Drake sections of this were some of the hardest to watch, just being real. I mean, it kind of just starts with just kind of showcasing Brian's role in Nickelodeon and how, you know, he would pop up on different shows. He was Pickle Guy, which was all like phallic jokes nonstop. He also has a history in Hollywood that extends beyond his relationship with Dan Snyder and Nickelodeon, where he was on Growing Pains. He was on Boy Meets World. He was on all these other shows. And like, when you, you know, later on, they kind of talk about all the people that were supporting him. You see that, you know, some of these people have just been in Hollywood for a long time, and he's been included into a group. And it's almost as if like, that mindset of like, oh, hey, you're new to Hollywood. You and your parents don't know anything about this. I know this. You can trust me. If you want to be successful, follow me. Specifically, your parents. Yeah, your dad does this. He doesn't know anything about Hollywood. Like, taking advantage of people who don't know Hollywood and using that to your advantage was something that clearly happened from this guy who was so clearly integrated into all of these shows, even beyond Nickelodeon.
Yeah, the thing about Brian Peck that I find disturbing, besides the fact that, you know, the John Wayne Gacy of it all, is this idea of everyone being like, oh, he was a dialect coach. However, he was everywhere. He's always around. He's like, and I don't know the industry that well. I don't know what dialect coaches do, but it did seem that he like took an interest in certain kids, specifically with Drake Bell. Drake's dad talks about how he was just able to see things and be like, yo, this is unnatural, and everyone else dismissing it. And I think that's the thing. It's like, so often when you're in workplaces, if someone raises a red flag, a lot of people, specifically groups of men, if they don't agree with it, or if they don't have the experience themselves, you're so quick to dismiss it. It's why women have such a hard time being able to flag sexual harassment or harassment of any kind, or being misheard. It's like, when someone complains about a dude and another dude doesn't have the same negative experience, it's so easy for people to overlook. And that really makes me upset, because it's very clear that anyone who's willing to actually listen to someone's concerns could see it. Like Drake's girlfriend's mom, they were like, oh, no, no. She got it immediately. It took her like 90 seconds to be like, something's not right about this.
Yeah. I can't help but to wonder, like, did Ryder Strong get shown these John Wayne Gacy letters? Did Will Friedle see this painting? Like, I know that this, I know we're going to get there, but like, these are some of the questions. Like, as I'm hearing these things about Brian, I'm like, well, yeah, you might not have known the specifics of what happened between him and Drake, but like, you knew this motherfucker, right? Like, you hung out with him. Ryder talks about being good friends with him. So I'm just wondering, like, not even just them, like, of all the adults that were around, like, all of these Blue's Clues are around and no one's putting them together. And I'm just like it's heartbreaking that it took this for this to happen, whereas, you know, there were so many signs that could have prevented this from even happening.
Yeah. So what we're talking about, this even happening, for those of you who didn't watch, Drake Bell comes on and he tells his story of like being in Hollywood, wanting to be an actor, getting kind of like small breaks, and then like his big break being on the Amanda Show. From the Amanda Show, they see that he and Josh Peck have chemistry and they want to like do a spinoff for it. So like, all of that is going on. In the meantime, Drake's dad is being ostracized because Drake's dad is constantly being like, there is something going on inappropriate between Brian Peck and my kid. And they essentially blackball his dad from being on set, but also, and then Brian Peck talks to Drake and is trying to like put in a wedge between that. Mm-hmm. They get the mom to have, I guess, custody of Drake, and the dad is like, you know what, that's fine, if that's what you want to do, do it, however, keep him away from Brian. And what does she do instead? She allows Brian to take over the role of his father. And
because one thing to point out is that Drake openly said that like his mom lived in Orange County. She lived like hour, like if you don't know Orange County from LA, it's like it could be a 2-hour drive. Like it's not something that you can just do like consistently every day, specifically if you're a parent or if you have a kid that needs to go around the auditions or whatever. So she would depend on Brian to be his LA chauffeur. He would spend the night at Brian's house. Brian would take him to auditions and all these things. And at a certain point, it was there were no other adults around. But Brian. So not only did Brian make himself so important to Drake's career, another thing I want to point out is that at the time that this abuse was happening, the idea of a Drake and Josh show was not fully there yet. It was hanging in the balance, almost as if like someone knew that like this was a very sensitive time for this actor, that he wouldn't want to mess up his career, and if I had any impulses, now is the time to strike. Because the fact that all of this happened before he even shot the pilot for Drake and Josh, and he was still like hoping that his career wouldn't get ruined, like all of that shit just feels so purposeful from Brian's perspective of just like, you know, now is the time where this kid has almost the most dependency on me more than ever.
Absolutely. And the idea that Brian would just show up everywhere. And I think that's really important because, first of all, Drake tells a story about how Brian would just show up to his concerts. He would just show up at random things. And like things are, as you said, it's like he would show up in like San Diego and you live in LA. And why are you at a kid's concert with friends in San Diego? Or he received birthday cards that seemed kind of inappropriate. And his dad would be like, what are these? And so again, like the signs. But instead the mom gives over control or like access to Brian for Drake. And then of course, inappropriate behavior happens, and kind of circling back, and I apologize, but circling back to it, in Ryder's letter, he talks about how Brian can't do it. Brian's a great guy. He shows up to support me in everything that I do. He's always there. And I was like, it's funny because in reality, what you are testifying to be supportive that this couldn't have happened is actually showing that it could have happened to you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, Brian developing close friend relationships with people like Ryder Strong or Kirk Cameron or Leonardo DiCaprio shows that this dude has a type, honestly. Yeah. Like, if more than anything, that's what I kind of got away from it, was that he constantly got close to these like teen heartthrobs in a way. Like, and I know that's kind of a weird thing to say, but
I think it's important. The young boys of it all is what's bothering to me,
because Drake was 14 at the time that this happened.
Drake was 14 at the time that it started, 15 when it was reported. There's so much that's going on to it. But I say all this to say that, as you were saying, Leo DiCaprio, Ryder Strong, Drake Bell, these are young men who Brian had an interest in and who was showing up and being there for all the time. And to me, that should be, like, if this man's circle are young men all, then that's weird. Like, why are you hanging around children? Again, I am hard pressed to know children of any kind, and let alone ones I'm not related to, let alone ones that I would go out of my way to see and be a part of their lives on a regular basis. Now, that is me. That's my experience. If you feel differently, that's one thing. But like, if this man is showing up to everyone and every young man that he has, and this man does not run a boys and girls club. Why is he there? Why is all of this happening?
You know, we're giving, okay. So just to quickly summarize this, Drake is spending all this time at Brian's house. Slowly abuse starts to happen. At first, Brian is very apologetic, says it's never going to happen again. I don't know what came over me. Then it just kind of continues and escalates to the point where Drake is physically uncomfortable, but he doesn't know how to separate himself from Brian. So he starts dating this girl and starts spending all of his time at his girlfriend's house. And we're called out a lot of parents that were real ones. This girlfriend's mom was a real one, because what she saw was a 42-year-old man calling a 17-year-old boy nonstop, a 15-year-old boy nonstop all day at multiple numbers trying to get a hold of him. She saw that, and within, like, he said, like, immediately she was able to be like, this isn't right. And I'm just like, yeah, like, I just feel like any parent would, right? Like, I don't know.
Not any parent would. We've shown this.
Yeah. I don't know if this goes into maternal or paternal instincts, or maybe this just goes into awareness and education. Like, maybe some parents just had more awareness and education towards these things, but it's interesting that it took his girlfriend's mom to step in where his mom didn't.
I think it has to do a lot with, as you said, awareness, mm-hmm. and just like really examining relationships. Like, again, why is this 42-year-old man hanging out with, mm-hmm. but definitely calling this child at this frequency? That's not your daddy. Like, yeah. You know, like, that's what, it's one of those things. It's just like, you need to examine, you need to ask yourself why. And I think a lot of people aren't asking themselves why. And again, I also think it's really, really important to note that the ones that do are also pushed to the side. I just really want to bring that. Now we get to the fact that Brian is arrested.
Mm-hmm.
He is convicted. And then he goes on this campaign where he is telling, like, Will and Ryder talk about this. They talk about the fact that he is going around and he's telling people, hey, this is the part that is, I'm so sorry, everyone, it's hard for me to talk about, but he goes around and he's telling everyone, hey, I found myself in a situation. According to Will and them, Will and Ryder say that he says, you know how certain men date young women? Well, I was dating this young man and he came on to me and it was a moment of weakness, and you know, I'm gay and my options are limited, and this kid also is gay and he came on to me, and then something happened and now he's reporting sexual harassment and our sexual assault. And I was like, at first, you and I talked about this very specifically, because Will says he was 19. He uses the phrase 19. And maybe he was 19 when he met Brian Peck. But Will was 27 when this is all going down.
Yeah.
He's a 27-year-old man. And Drake Bell is 15. At the time of the trial, Drake Bell is 18. And Will is 29, I believe. But point being is, we are talking about someone in their late 20s. And their comparison, the opposition, is a 15, 16-year-old man. Boy.
Yeah. I honestly, like, this is the part where it's like, it gets really hard, because yes, if you listen to the Pod Meets World episode, they discuss how, you know, Brian gave them misinformation and in many ways kind of brought them into his abuse in various ways. But it is really hard to think that, you know, anyone could say, well, yeah, I mean, that 14-year-old was coming on to him, so what was he supposed to do? Or like, well, yeah, he did it, but he's not going to do it again. And it's like, well, I don't know how you overlook that. And like, I re-listened to their Pod Meets World episode.
Yep.
And I was just like, I still don't know if this is enough to like get the smoke off of you guys. And I know that, like, you know, there's a lot of like personal feelings of them feeling like they were victimized, but it's to see that an actual victim. And I mean, I'll say this, the documentary goes on to talk about the actual trial.
Yeah.
In which, like, Drake says, you know, I came into the hearing and my side really just had me and my mom, and the other side was filled with all of these Hollywood insiders there to support Brian. And the comments that me and my mom were making were basically like, you know, you guys are all here to support this dude, but anytime I think of him, I'm going to think of this abuse that happened to me.
The exact quote is, and I wanted to, because it was such an impactful,
mm-hmm.
Drake Bell says, you will forever have the memory of sitting in this courtroom and defending this person. And I'll forever have the memory of the person you're defending violating me and doing unspeakable acts and crimes. And that's what I'll remember. And That is so impactful because it really does show, A, to me, it kind of gives me a little bit more context into Will's stance and Ryder's position when that episode came out.
Yeah.
Because absolutely, as Drake said, it's like that's their memory. Their memory is being in the courtroom. And that's the other part of me that has a problem with what I heard in their original episode is they were in the courtroom. You're not talking about someone in theory. Like, you could say that you wrote a letter of support and then, like, you never met the person. You didn't have the specifics. But when you know that it was a child, when you go and you see that it's a young person, how do you not recant your statement?
I mean, to give the Pod Meets World guys a little bit of understanding, there is a moment in their conversation where they talk about actually being in the hearing and then kind of getting that hit of reality of just being like, what the fuck am I doing here or whatever. It's hard when the damage is already done. Like, it's hard to, like, honestly read the letters that Will and Ryder wrote for him. And I'm sure there was misinformation, but I just don't know how much misinformation you could do to spin something like this. Like, really, like, we don't know when the letters were written compared to when the hearing happened. There's so much we don't know, but the optics aren't great. The optics don't look good.
The opposites are not great. And I want everyone to know, like, first of all, I've already reached out to Jensen and I've already told him that we wanted to ask him these questions. If we go to the season four recap and we do not ask him any questions, know that it was not because we did not want to.
Yeah.
I have questions. I feel like it's our responsibility as the voice of the fans to say something. So if we don't say something, know that it was not because we chickened out. I just want to point that out there. That's number one. Number two is I stand by my statement of, it is good for Will and Ryder to have come on and say, hey, we supported someone we should not have. We did not have all the information at the time. We were biased towards our relationship with him. I'm with you. I feel like I stand by that in a way, specific certain ways, Ryder was definitely someone who didn't have people telling him your maturity is not all-encompassing.
Well,
like,
I also feel that Ryder was probably more groomed than Will was.
Correct, and I completely agree with that. And so because of that, I still have empathy and sympathy for both of them because we don't know that relationship. And by the way, I don't know when the letters were written. I don't know all of the conversations that were had. What I do know is this man had a signed photograph of John Wayne Gacy that he was proud to share.
Yeah.
I do know that the defendant was a 15-year-old man and that Brian Peck admitted to the things that were in the lawsuit, which include...
Well, he admitted to two counts. So I don't know what two counts he agreed to, but some of the things that he was accused of were like brutal, violent acts, like sexual acts.
Well, sexual acts, but no matter what, he admitted to, whether it's a peck on the cheek, a massage, or whatever it is, he admitted to being a 42-year-old man who had relationship, an inappropriate relationship, with a 15-year-old child. And that is where I just gotta, like, dude, you gotta be like, hey.
You know, here's the thing I tried to do, because when you watch the documentary, one of the things that's really interesting is that Drake goes on to say that, like, after all this happened, the one person who was kind of there for him was Dan Schneider, which kind of lets you know, like, how confusing it can be for children to be thrown into situations like that and how confusing it could be for young people. Again, I know Ryder was a little bit younger, so maybe he falls into that category. One of the things I looked up that I just thought was interesting, did you know that... The Violence Against Women Act, which is the law that basically was trying to help with domestic violence issues, didn't pass until 1994. Yeah. Like, in terms of, like, hey, there's something going on at my home that's violent. We were, as a society, taught to not talk about that outside of the house. Yeah. And I'm not saying that, like, by the time this happened in the mid-2000s, we hadn't moved past that. But I do think there were generations of people who were raised with that mindset of like, yeah, I saw this at home, but I'm not going to say anything. And how that can kind of translate to like the workplace or other people's homes and things like that. I'm trying to empathize with everyone as much as I can, but it's just like my stomach is still churning. Like I had nightmares last night. Like this is gross. Like I feel gross, and I don't feel like there's any way to kind of like paint a good picture for anyone. Truly.
I think one of my responsibilities is that I am not responsible for painting a good picture. Mm-hmm. I think that with everything, life is complex. I think that people mm-hmm. Are allowed to do good work and also make decisions that you would not agree with. I feel like it is very right to ask. I feel like Drake Bell, whose response to Boy Meets World and Rolling Writers pod episode was like, oh, this is a PR stint. I feel like that's fair for Drake to say.
Actually, hold on. Give me a second, because I actually want to read his response, because this is what Drake posted on the Pod Meets World Instagram in response to the episode. He said, Will was 27 years old and Brian told him what he did. Many turned away and said, no, I won't write a letter, but they did. Will was not manipulated. Brian admitted to him and he wrote the letter anyway. Then he worked with me on many, many episodes of Spider-Man years later and never said a word to me about it. This is because they were told the letters were going to be made public. Everyone thought the letters would be sealed forever and no one would ever see them. This is their publicist telling them to get ahead of the story. Again, Drake obviously is still very hurt by this. So I don't know how accurate that is to Will and Ryder's perspective of it, but that's how the victim feels about it. And so it's important to kind of throw that out there. Another asterisk I want to put on all of this is that what Drake went through, as heartbreaking as it was, also does not excuse his behavior later in life when he gets caught, you know, eliciting, underage minor. So cycles of abuse obviously are terrible, but like one abuse does not excuse another. So I just wanted to throw that up.
I love that you brought that up. And the reason, what I wanted to say is, I feel like Drake is valid to be like, hey, I have yet to receive an apology.
Yeah. Because I feel like that's what was the point of that, was like, hey, I worked with you, bro, and you never even said anything to me about it. Yeah.
Correct. Like, and again, to me, have your apology be as loud as your violation. You know, like that's how I feel truly and deeply. And then also this idea that I feel like Will may have a specific feeling about it, because Will very proudly in his letter says, hey, I like Brian so much, I've taken him from place to place, from job to job. I gave him access to more things. How could I possibly like not think that this is a good man if I'm bringing him anywhere? And there is this idea of, oh, I gave him more access to
sure him. And also like this thing where like people often are quick to question someone else over their own judgment. So it's almost that thing of like, it's not that I didn't question this person or I didn't think this person was weird. I just trusted myself and my gut instincts so much that I believe I would have been able to figure out that situation through instinct versus, you know, what was happening.
Absolutely. So that is kind of like the summary of what's going on. Again, the thing that I also want to talk about is the idea that Peck is convicted. He's sent to jail for 16 months. That is not enough. Like, I'm so upsetting that is where we're at.
And continue to work on children's programming afterwards. What the fuck are we doing that this dude was on Sweet Life of Zach and Cody?
I have said continuously that I find it so upsetting that they gave him Zach and Cody, another show with two young boys. You didn't even give him Hannah Montana. You didn't even give him, like, you didn't even like go outside of what he was accused for. You went to the direct thing that he was violated for. And then they said that they asked him about it. And he was like, oh, it's handled. It's in the past. And I was just like, what are we doing? Why do mediocre white men continue to get opportunity after opportunity? You could be a convicted sex offender, and that is not going to stop your career advancement.
The white privilege of it. Amazing. The white privilege of it is notable. The one thing else I wanted to mention about him finding work afterwards is that some of the, like, not only did he get letters from actors like James Marsden and, you know, a few other people, but he also got letters of support from crew members who said, not only do I stand next to Brian, but I would continue to work with him in the future, despite all of this, and which ended up happening. So it's just, it sucks. It sucks that this dude was able to keep working. I don't know where he is now, but I hope he's not working with children.
I will say that to me, this is a conversation about accountability and holding our friends and our community accountable, like holding our coworkers accountable. Like there has to be some, like people have to speak up, and I'm glad that people are speaking up now. And I will admit that it was not a space where people, like we were not rewarding people for speaking up in the early 2000s. That was not a thing. If, again, if this episode showed anything, it's that we punished people. When people say, why don't victims of abuse speak up more? Drake Bell spoke up, went to court. The other guy admitted to it, and he still had 41 people, 41 letters of support, and a crowd of people supporting him versus a, at the time, I think 18-year-old kid. So that's why people don't speak up. I get it. However, we have to be better at holding our peers accountable and being like, hey, dude, why in the world are you hanging out with a 15-year-old? I'm gonna need answers. I'm gonna need someone to tell me. I need you to explain to me the importance and the relevance of you having any kind of relationship with someone under the age of 18.
A few things I want to add on. I thought it was really interesting that the series ends with almost this montage of child stars who kind of fell from grace in the public eye. And we start with a Corey Haim, who was Corey Feldman to this day is like, hey, Charlie Sheen raped this dude. Like he to this day is like, he did it. Other people saw it. Like there are so many instances of like the people that they showed, Drew Barrymore, who was allowed in clubs when she was 13 years old, Britney Spears, who we know everything that happened there. Like these people who had this fall of grace that were on the cover of paparazzi magazines and shit like that. All of them were exploited or abused in some way, shape, or form. And as a society, our response was to go, ha, look at how they're handling fame. Aren't they crazy? Aren't they like unprofessional or whatever? And it was just this victim blaming that as a society, we were encouraged to do that would prevent someone from speaking out.
Yeah, absolutely. That part right there, this blaming of the victim and being like, you should have done better. And that's where I'm actually like, we were talking about the gray area earlier. I feel like this is a lot of gray area in terms of where Will and Ryder sit, because I don't know exactly how much they knew, but I do know that Will at least was 27. So, you know, there is a lot of, I don't want to blame like Brandy's mom or, any other parent who like saw something but didn't say anything, but at the exact same time, I can say you should have known better. Like at the end of the day, I'm always going to side with the children. And I feel like we have to ask ourselves, even as people who don't have children, we constantly feel like anyone who has access to fame gets what they deserve. But when a child has access to fame, what are we doing? Why should we hold them to the same standards as we do grown adults?
One of the other things I want to just throw out there is that in the Pod Meets World episode, they kind of talk about, like, Ryder said, I don't think this is a Hollywood problem. I think this is just, like, an issue that's everywhere. And maybe so that, you know, abuse of children happens in churches or communities around the country. But, like, the system of Hollywood is made to isolate children from parents or you know, parental figures in a way that this documentary is able to highlight, like, hey, very few could probably stand up for themselves or get out of a situation like this without the help of a parent or someone who cares for them, an adult that has eyes on them. And so it's like, yeah, Hollywood isn't the only place this happens, but damn if it doesn't happen a lot.
Well, yeah, it's not the only place that it happens, but also we have, like, again, they're talking about the fact that I believe Brian Hearn was talking about child labor laws and be like, oh, we breaking child labor laws and everybody cool with that?
Yeah.
like everyone's okay with it. Okay, cool. And this idea of people seeing violations, seeing someone get a massage, seeing someone be abused verbally, seeing someone do power plays on children or women in the workplace, and all of those things, and being okay with it. Like, I think we can't, like, Hollywood is not the only place to which this happens, but it is a place that it happens enough that we can't address. Like, that's one of the things. It's like, if we can start with Hollywood, if we can hold Hollywood accountable, then maybe we can hold other people accountable in other places, because everyone has the understanding. It's not lost on me that with Me Too coming out and exposing a spotlight on what was wrong in Hollywood, that Me Too movement was able to spread throughout, and people were able to say, hey, that happens in this industry as well. That happens over here as well. And I think that Hollywood is not the end all be all, but it is part of a system that perpetuates it is fine for people to be violated, for people to have their rights violated, for people to not be paid what they're supposed to be paid, for people to just constantly be taken advantage of for the sake of money. And we can't say for the sake of art, because it's very clear that art is not at the forefront of these arguments.
This is the capitalism argument that I stated at the top of the show, which is how many people didn't say anything because they were afraid to lose their job?
Yeah.
That's the number one reason people said why they didn't say shit was because they didn't want to get in trouble at their job.
Exactly.
Because people need money. And when your child is the breadwinner of a family, what does that mentally do to you to make you over? Like, does it require you to overlook stuff? Do you think like, oh, maybe I just don't know enough? Like, that's too much responsibility for a child to have, really.
Wait, like, it's, to be honest, I'm 30-something, and I feel like it's too much responsibility for me to have. But, like, that's the thing. It is all tied to capitalism and patriarchy and all of these things that allow people in power to degrade other human beings and take advantage of them. And I think that's important, because everyone needs to know that if they will do it to others, if they'll do it in other industries, if you allow them to do it to your coworker, what's to stop them from doing it to you? Really quickly, I want to talk about after the doc was released. You had said earlier, a lot of people, cast members who were like, oh, not only do I like this man, but I'll continue to work with him and all this other stuff. The cast of Ned's Declassified, after the documentary was released. I will say that the stars said that they didn't watch the video when they released their own little live reaction, but they were like, none of that stuff was going on over here. Like, he was violating the other people, but we were cool. That ain't happened to us. And I was like, I think I need people to have more empathy and understand, as I said earlier, if they were doing it to someone else, then there's a good chance it was a roll of a dice that it didn't happen to you. Or maybe it did happen to someone you know, and you just made a joke out of it, so you didn't create a safe space for that person to tell you.
Definitely.
Like, Drake talks about the fact that when Brian is caught, his dad is like, oh my God, I knew something was wrong with that man. Thank God it didn't happen to you. And Drake, the person who the lawsuit is around, didn't have the heart to tell his father. Because there was, like, again, I'm not blaming him, but I will say there was no space for Drake to come to his father. And we have to hold space for people to be vulnerable with us and say, hey, this is what's happening to me. Or, hey, you know that thing, that story that happened? I have my own tale.
Yeah. The Dan Schneider response to it all, Dan Schneider got one of the what's the dude? Where's he from?
I don't even know his name.
Some TV show that Dan produced clearly bought this dude out to have this interview that Dan clearly scripted. And one of the things I want to talk about in terms of that response video, which was just all bullshit, like I wouldn't even recommend people watch it. Dan's whole thing is basically like, you know what? I'm sorry if some people were uncomfortable, but there were a lot of other adults in the room, and everything was kind of, there were studio heads around. And if I'm the problem, then all these other people are the problem, essentially. And I kind of don't disagree with that. I'm not saying I excuse anything, but for Dan Schneider to say like, if I was such a problem, why was I allowed to keep going on, essentially, is something that that's the big question. That is the question.
So it's so funny when you say that, because this is what people are talking about. Like, you and I go back and forth with this all the time. Or not even back and forth. We just kind of bring it up all the time, where it's like, that's how white men think. White men think it can't be a problem because people are letting me do it. And if people are letting me do it, then obviously everyone's okay with it. And it is our responsibility as a society to start calling people out. This is what I said earlier about accountability. It is not lost on me that Dan Schneider is very much like a, excuse me, there were checks and balances in place. Ain't nobody say anything so clearly. And it's like, you're forgetting the power dynamics. You're forgetting that you very proudly stated that everyone's well-being and finances were in your hand. Like, so they weren't encouraged or even had room to criticize you. There are so many people. We all have bosses or coworkers who make everyone feel uncomfortable, but they also have to weigh, is my well-being, is putting food on my table worth standing up and saying something? And in terms of companies, there are so many companies who will also be like, hey, I see his behavior. I wouldn't take that. But nobody on his staff is complaining. And since we don't have any complaints, we can't do anything about it. And so
Well,
the
I just one thing I just want to say, because Dan Schneider says, makes it seem like, oh, if there was a problem, people would have said anything. The documentary says that this motherfucker had like three internal investigations against him. So people, like, there were people who were like, this, something's wrong. He
But
just kept getting away with it.
we talk about this all the time. It's There are two things. One, it's the idea of how much money is he making us? What is the cost of doing something about the problem versus doing the right thing? And we've really moved away from doing the right thing, and we're way more focused on doing the cost beneficial thing.
100%.
So there's that. That's one of the problems. And another problem is very similar to what a lot of people in this documentary, the adults, have to deal with is the idea of if I let him get away with that, what does that say about me? If he gets in trouble for what he did, what does that say about me? What does it say about my behaviors? What does it say about what I did? And I think that that's another problem that we're having. We have a problem of people not being willing to own their part in the problem.
And I mean, as much as people may not be completely satisfied with the Pod Meets World episode, I do appreciate that they were at least able to have the conversation where they talk about being a part of the problem and kind of reflecting on their role in it.
I will say, like, to that point, I think it's really important to say that we said in our last video, they didn't have to say anything. They didn't, like, we don't know this person. This was like, turns out they had to say something
They
because this
had
was
to,
coming
because
out.
they were actively named. Both of them were named.
They were actively named and shown on camera. Like, we had photos of them. headshots and names and descriptions were shared. So they did have to say something. And I think that's important to note because we were very much like, they didn't have to do this. I still think that it was good that they did this. I still think that it puts them in a situation of having to explain further their position and why they did what they did. But I think that that may encourage them to examine things a little bit closer. And we'll see if they touch on the subject again and if they are willing to unpack and kind of really discuss why they even had the video and actually be willing to answer and be a little bit of vulnerable. I don't know if they will. I can't say if they will, yes or no, but I can say that it was not wrong of them to at least express regret of being involved in making these statements. I do think that they owe Drake Bell an apology, and I would encourage everyone to not hide in the shadows when you see something going wrong and really ask yourself if the situation that you are being shared feels inappropriate.
The other thing I wanted to say is that, like, I saw people commenting online, kind of really doubling down, giving Will and Ryder a hard time. And I can understand their frustrations, but we have to understand that, like, there's a Dave Chappelle comedy bit, and however you feel about him, that's fair. But he talks about how the Me Too movement, and he was like, in South Africa, when they were trying to abolish apartheid, what they realized was like, hey, we can't just call out one person because one person will blame another person who said they got orders from everyone. We have to put like the system on trial and not people on trial. Because when the system is on trial, people feel comfortable speaking out and say, yes, I was complicit. I did do this. I did something that was shitty, but I under the context of there was an environment that made me feel okay for that. And I may be a victim because I was influenced by that. I like there's bigger conversations to happen than blaming two people who wrote a letter for their friend. And I'm not excusing it, but I'm just saying that that's not the problem, really. The problem is a society that has allowed this to happen to begin with. So,
no, I agree with you. And I love that. I think that to your point, and what we've been saying is we have to look at all these systems. I personally am keep going back to this idea of what we said earlier, where Ryder was like, everyone's like getting down on Hollywood and Hollywood's not that bad of a place. It's like, it's not, but we still need to call out Hollywood. We still need to protect children. Like I would say I was talking to my husband about this, and one thing that this and Pod Meets World and all of these like behind the scenes things that we're learning, is this idea of people should be protecting children more. We have to re-examine our relationship with child actors and not just trust the studios. Like what we all should know what is allowed on set. Like we should all be like, there should be no time violations. Like all of these things should be examined. Anytime a child actor is like, oh, I have a really close relationship with this person who is not my co-star, and even if they are their co-star, just like we should really be examining these things. And then also in the Dan Schneiderness of it all, I want apologies and money. I want apology. Like it's fine to say, oh, I misunderstood what I was doing and I was a really bad person and all this other stuff, but like you were violating people financially, you were doing power plays career-wise. You should, if anything, be this is what I'm talking about. When I want apologies, I want action. Sure. I want change. I want accountability. Like it's not enough to say, hey, I understand what I did was wrong. It's like, how are you correcting that problem? And I think that that's kind of the thing with Will and Ryder. It's like you put out a podcast and you talked about how you regretted it, but according to Drake, you still haven't apologized. Like, what are you doing to make up the difference? Like, what are you doing to take accountability? And how loud is your apology compared to your violation?
And to, again, to, you can't, I don't know how many excuses you can make for Hollywood as a place. When you think about not just a Dan Schneider, when you think about a P. Diddy, when you think about a Lou Pearlman, like their entertainment, unfortunately, has it's almost like the NBA, where so few people make it that those who do are so open for exploitation because they have everything to lose, you know. And these are people who are artists who just want to pursue their dreams and make a living at it. And unfortunately, the only way to do that, at least historically, was to go through these systems that would often take advantage of them. And so there's just a bigger conversation probably that needs to be had about Hollywood in general.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. Speaking of, as we kind of wrap this conversation up, I want to talk about the book. It's a little mini homework. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the book, I'm Glad My Mom Died by Jeanette McCurdy.
Yeah.
Because Jeanette McCurdy is one of these people who came out and talked about her experiences on the Nickelodeon set. She is someone who kind of explored the things that were happening behind the scenes, the abuse that she experienced, and going back to the NSD classified kids, was belittled for it.
Yeah.
Was belittled and made fun of. Even Josh Peck, who is the co-star of Drake Bell in Drake and Josh, defended Dan Schneider and his whole relationship with this. And I think people, now that Quiet on the Set has come out, are willing to re-examine her story and kind of look a little bit closer, which I think is great. But also, I think that it's a testimony to the number of people who will say something along the lines of, well, it didn't happen to me. Yeah. And I think that we can all use a lesson in empathy by reading and hearing other people's story and learning that even though it didn't happen to me, it happened to someone And I should still be upset about that.
I'm kind of still waiting for some of the other Nickelodeon talent to make a comment. Like, it feels weird that Keenan hasn't said anything. It feels weird. Like, it may not have happened to you, but like, you were clearly so close to Dan Schneider, you and Kel both, that it's odd that you guys aren't saying anything. I don't know.
I have my own thoughts, and I'll keep them because they're just that, they're thoughts, that there's no real basis. But speaking of the Nezzy Classified kids, I think it's funny that they came out and they were very much like, oh, and it happened to us, but they also constantly talk about how they were having sex on set, and they had access to alcohol and drugs and like all this other stuff. And it's like, yeah, maybe the sexual violation didn't happen to you, but you absolutely were not supervised in the way that you should have been.
Sure.
And this idea of so many kids, like, we hear very often Pod Meets World speak about, everyone's like, oh, guys, you were so nice, and you had really good parents and family. And I just think about all of the kids, especially in the last few decades, who have been on Disney shows, who don't have that support system, who don't have as good of an experience as Will, Danielle, and Ryder had. And even their experience was like traumatizing from a work perspective. So I just really think that at the end of the day, we should be listening to children's stories. We should be re-examining the young Hollywood system and the child actor system, mm-hmm. and making sure that we are not necessarily helicoptering, but we are paying attention to the systems that are currently in place and how they can be improved.
You know what's so crazy? Even after this whole conversation, like, there's still things about that documentary we didn't touch on. Like, if you haven't watched it, like, and I know that some people might not want to, and I get that, and that's fair. We talked on some of the big things, but there's still so much that we didn't touch on. So, like, yeah, I would encourage people who are curious to, like, get this firsthand information instead of getting it secondhand through us, to give it a try and try watching it if it's not too triggering for you.
I think about the idea of what Sav said about Chasing Amy being a life raft for him, and the idea that that is what he needed at the time. And now that he is older and he knows some truths behind it and it's not as great, he doesn't need it. He has other things to be the life raft. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why people are having a hard time learning about these things, these uncomfortable truths and these behind the scenes situations. It's because they don't have other life rafts. Like, these are the things that are making us happy. These are the things that give us a good feeling. And the more that you have to let go, the more you realize that you're just kind of floating, you know?
Oh,
heavy
episode, guys. Heavy episode.
I desperately want to know what you guys thought. We got so many people reaching out to us asking us if we were going to cover Quiet on the Set. We already had this planned, so it was already in the pipes, but the Boy Meets World, the Will and writer of it all, absolutely had to be addressed. And again, as of this moment, we have reached out. I haven't heard whether or not they will allow us to speak on it. I don't know if it's behind the rear window for them or if there's something that they're going to speak on at a later time. But we do want to encourage you guys to tell us your stories, to reach out to us if you have any questions, anything that you wanted to say about this episode or other episodes or Quiet on the Set. Also, if you or anyone you know needs help, contact the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673. Again, see something, say something. We want you guys to be safe out there.
Guys, don't forget to turn in to Bruh Meets World next week for some regularly scheduled programming. Don't forget to leave us a rating, a review on your favorite podcast platform if you want to keep up with us. Follow us on all the places, Bruh Meets World. And you know what, guys? Mentally, be safe. Like, there's a lot of triggering shit out there. And if you need a break, take a break.
Absolutely. We say this all the time, but again, I think it's really important to remember that you can still dream.
And you can still try.
And you can still do good.
It's never too late to do good.
All right. Later, bros.
Later, bros. This episode of Bruh Meets World was produced by Siege and edited by Tony Curtis. Bruh Meets World is a Two Free Tokens media production. When this boy meets world.